This week, the portion is called Parshat Balak. You know, for some of us who read the newspapers, this doesn't disturb us all that much. A bunch of anti-Semites out there plotting our destruction, so we're quite used to it. The difference between today versus then is today they have mass media to let us know about it. You can just turn in on BBC or CNN and find out about it. So this shouldn't surprise you all that much. What is interesting about this portion is that it's one of the few times in the Chumash that we have a whole section where the focus of the narrative has shifted. It's not what's going on in the Jewish camp. It's the Jews are going about their business, but it's outside of the camp. And, you know, we can just be going on and speaking about whatever mundane things or holy things we speak about, not knowing that there are people outside of the camp who are attacking us terribly. And that's part of what, I guess, is disturbing. The beginning of the portion is unclear, yet essential to understand what's going on. Vayar Balak ben Tzippor et kol asher asa Yisrael lamori. Background is that Balak read last week's parsha. He saw what happened prior to this. Vayogar Moav mipnei ha'am ma'od ki ravhu. It means that Moav, the people of Moav, became very frightened about the nation, meaning the Jews, because they were very numerous. Vayakatz Moav mipnei b'nei Israel. And then it goes on and says that they were disgusted about the Jewish people. Now that itself is interesting. By the way, there's one thing which has been totally left out. And that is to tell us identity, who this Moab is. Identity, who Balak is. It tells us that Balak saw what the Jews did. Point number one, statement number one. Second, it tells us that the people of Moab are frightened. Third thing that it tells us, the people of Moab are disgusted towards the Jews. Next point, Bayoma Moab el Ziknei Midyon. Moab speaks to Midyon. And they say something quite poetic. Now the congregation will lick up our entire surroundings as an ox licks up the greenery of the field. And then it tells us, after this poetic statement about how the Jews are going to spread out, it says, "Ubalak ben Tzippor melech Moav ve'esahi." And Balak was the king of Moab at this time. And all of us sense, that if we were writing this, if we were editing this, we would have shifted this around. The first thing you would have said is that there was a king. I mean, you would have started one way or the other. Either you would have identified Balak as the king right away from the beginning, or what you would have done is that you would have gone the opposite way, is you first would have said about the problem, and then you would have brought in Balak. Meaning, you wouldn't have done it this way. You wouldn't have mentioned about Balak, and then shift, without telling us who he is, then shifted to the problem, and then coming back and identifying who Balak is. It's not a very clear way of doing things. Which leads some of the commentaries to the observation that maybe when the story starts, Balak isn't king. Is that what he does is that this should not surprise any of us who have lived through or who have read about the 20th century. He uses his anti-Semitism as part of his platform in order to move himself towards a position of leadership. Which means, what do you have over here? You have hatred towards the Jews and fear towards the Jews. It's actually the other way around. Fear towards the Jews and then hatred towards the Jews. That's a good way to start. Fear turning into hatred, turning into Balak becoming king. Which means that before, the starting point could have been fear. Fear moves towards hatred, but then someone says, well, you know, I will get a final solution. I'll deal with this. I'll be the ones who'll be able to take care of this. He's the one who becomes leader. As I said, that's what the rabbis point out over here when they notice the very awkward way of starting the portion. Now, obviously, we're not going to just tell you what other people say, because to do that, you wouldn't have had to come to class. Let's understand who the players are. And there's one important player who's about to be introduced, and that is Bilam. It's the next verse says, "Vayishlach malachim milachim." They send messengers, El Bilam ben Baor, Pitora, Asher al Nahar, Eretz Bnei Amo, Lekrolo. And they send messengers to this fellow named Bilam, to the place called Pitor, by the river, by this land, by his people, to call him. Lekrolo, Lemor, Hine Am Yatz Mitzrayim, this nation has left Egypt. Hine Kisat Ein Haaretz V'Yoshev Muli. He covers up the land, they're spreading out all over the place, and he's sitting opposite of me. I mean, and I don't think that you have to work too hard to notice some of the classic anti-Semitic statements which come over here. The Jews are all over the place, they're taking over, they're spreading out. But what I want to focus on first, we'll see how much time we have to see how far we can get. What I want to focus on first is the identity of the players involved in this. Who do we have so far? We have Balak, who I dealt with a little bit. We have the people of Moab, we have the people of Midian, and we have Bilam. And in order to understand what's really going on over here, we have to identify who they are, what their concern is, what their background is, and maybe more importantly, why they should have known better. So let's start off with the easiest one. Who are the two nations here that we have in front of us? Moab and Midian. Who is Moab and who is Midian? And if you know this, then you're most of your way towards your resolution.
Didn't Moshe Rabbeinu marry?
That's true, but that doesn't tell us who they are yet. That's good. You've identified one important part about them, but you don't know who they are yet. Who is Moab? Where did Moab arrive from? So you have this is why you have to go back sometimes and pay attention in Genesis, in Bereishis, when it says, and this person gave birth to this person, gave birth to this person, gave birth to this person, because when you ignore those things, then you don't know who the players are later on. Moab is the easy one, because the word Moab, the name Moab, the etymology of Moab is something which is quite disturbing. Moab from the father. Moab is the child who's produced when Lot has an affair with his daughter. When Lot escapes from the city of Sodom, apparently he practices the behavior of Sodom, he allows himself to get drunk, to be seduced by his daughter, and she brazenly names her child Moab. Moab meaning from the father. Again, there's no embarrassment over here on her part. So what does that make Moab? So don't just tell me it makes him illegitimate. It makes him much more than that. What does that make Moab? And of course, the way that I want to say it is the way that will disturb you the most. What does it make Moab? It makes him our cousin. Because after all, who was Lot? Lot was Abraham's nephew. So if Lot is Abraham's nephew, and this is Abraham, and this is Lot's son and grandson. So what does this make Moab? It makes him a relative of ours. Okay? That's something that we need to keep in mind. Which leads us to the next point. Who is Midian? So you're correct that Moshe spent some time in Midian. What else do we know about Midian? So one of the things that the Torah tells us after Sarah dies is that Abraham remarries. But Yosef Avram Yikach Ishu Shmo Keturah. And Avram took another wife, and her name was Keturah. The rabbis tell us that this Keturah may actually be another name for Hagar, which is less of a concern for me to identify who she was. But what it does tell us, Vatelo es Zimron es Yakshan ve es Midon ve es Midian. And one of the people that she gave birth to was somebody named Midian. So now, who is Midian? Midian is also a relative of Avraham, which means coming from the Jewish perspective, being the children of Yitzchak, the children of Yaakov, when we look at these two nations, Moab and Midian, what do we now realize? We now realize that Moab and Midian are both part of the larger Abraham family. So, the importance of this, first of all, just knowing this information is already important. How we put this together will take a little bit more work. But what I think the significance of this is that we have the Abraham family. We have the extended Abraham family. We have the legitimate heirs, and then we have the people who are the have-nots. Now, let's start with Lot for a second, because Lot is a very interesting character. To a very large extent, Lot represents an incredible tragedy. For many years, Lot is the right-hand man of Abraham. Where Abraham goes, Lot goes. Abraham adopts him. When he has no children, he's the one that looks as if he'll be the continuation of Abraham's line. Now, let's not overstate the argument, but I think we can all agree that at that particular juncture, Abraham was the greatest man in the world. Again, he's the one true monotheist. He finds God. He finds morality. He finds decency. And what do we find? That Abraham and Lot can't get along. Now, and their shepherds get into a fight and they divide, they go in different directions. If you were Lot, what would you do? You would do all you could to stay in Abraham's house. You would do all you could to stay in Abraham's tent. Which leads me then to a very disappointing observation. It probably wasn't easy to grow up in Abraham's house. But the standards of morality are such that it's very difficult to really look good in Abraham's house. And if you go up in Abraham's house, the standards that he expected in terms of behavior, decency, interpersonal relationships, and was probably such that the standards were so high that regular people felt inadequate. Isn't it fascinating what Lot does? He goes to stone. What will he be able to do in stone? He'll be able to... No, that's not it. He'll be able to stand out in stone. In stone, he'll look impressive. In stone, he'll look like a great person. In stone, he'll look like a leader. I mean, do you realize how pathetic that is? Rather than feel inadequate in Abraham's house, again, this is what he needed to go to therapy for. Instead of feeling inadequate in Abraham's house, he decides that he's going to be a star in stone. He'll be the preacher of stone. Do you all realize how pathetic that is to be the preacher of stone? I mean, yes, he'll be the moral voice of stone. But he probably feels good about that. And that's what the whole thing is about him feeling good about himself. That's where Moab comes from. Now, one thing that it tells us about Moab is that Moab should have known better. Which means, why should Moab know better? Because if your ancestor grew up in Abraham's house, you know what decency is. You know what kindness is. You know what it means to take care of strangers. You have seen firsthand all of these things. Which means Lot growing up in Abraham's house not only had an obligation to live on that kind of standard, you know what else he had? He had an obligation to pass on that moral message to his descendants. And that, therefore, when the descendants of Lot are ready to meet up with the descendants of Abraham, what should they do? By the way, the Torah says this. What I'm telling you right now, the Torah says it in black and white. They should be reaching out to them, going out and saying, our long-lost cousins, please come home. Can we get you anything? Can we do anything? Can we share our homes with you? Can we show you our hospitality? But instead, how does this portion begin? Moab is frightened and Moab is disgusted. That's fascinating. Why are they frightened and why are they disgusted? Which means these are not some foreign, strange tribe marching in from Africa. These are their long-lost relatives. And apparently the standards of behavior, which they themselves know they're supposed to be keeping, is what frightens them. What disgusts them is the way that the Jewish people will make them feel about themselves. I mean, the one thing that Lot would have succeeded in doing and dealing with his own inadequacy by leaving the house of Abraham and fathering a child with his own daughter is now creating a whole line of people who are going to feel inadequate, especially when the line of this people will now be called Moab, which is going to, you know, permanently put the name of their sin upon the name of this nation. And as I said, the daughter wasn't even embarrassed about it. That's what happens when you raise your daughter in stone. So now we move over to the other heroes in this. Who are they? Midian, which means here are the children of Abraham, but the children who aren't chosen. The children who are considered lesser children. And that's a very difficult way to grow up. To know that there's a great world leader named Abraham, to know that Abraham is a message, it tells us over here, when it talks about Abraham's children, the next verse says, "V'yitin Avram es kol asher lo liYitzchak," and Abraham gave everything he owned to Yitzchak. And by the way, let's not make a mistake about this. I believe this to be both in terms of moral lessons as well as actual inheritance in terms of wealth and holdings and properties. And then it says, "Uluvneha pelagshim," but to the children of the concubines, "Asher la'avam nasan Avraham, natan Avraham matanot," Avraham gave them gifts. Rashi over here says, what kind of gifts did he give? Pirshu Rabotenu, Shem Tum'a Masar Lahem, that he gave them abilities within black magic. That itself is completely fascinating. Which is also, I think, quite interesting when we see what happens over here. We have over here a confederacy. The confederacy is between the Abraham, I don't know what to call them, the people that are outside of the lineage, the people who are connected but disconnected. They're the ones who come together. They're the ones who know about the spiritual gifts that Avraham has. They're the ones who know about what Avraham is passing on to the next generation through Yitzchak, through Yaakov, and the Jews who will stand at Sinai. They're aware of this, but that's something which frightens them and something which they reject. You just as easily could have anticipated that they would have come back and said, our long-lost cousins, you know, you stood at Sinai, God spoke to you, share with us, give to us, tell us what it was. What was the message? What did God tell you? Again, you can imagine just as easily, you know the scene, I'm sure you've seen the movie, if not it's in the Chumash, where Aaron meets up with Moses after all those years and he sees that Moses has changed. And what happened? God spoke to him at the burning bush. So, share with me. What does God want? What's the message? What's the task? What's the destiny? And over here, instead of people identifying with that destiny, we have the opposite. We have people that are frightened by it and disgusted by it. What do they do? Now, what they do is fascinating. They turn to a man named Bilam. And we have to notice something. Bilam, the word, again, if we focused on Moab, the word Bilam, the name Bilam, the etymology, comes from Bili'am, without a nation, Bala'am, to swallow up a nation. Bilam is a loner. Bilam is different from everyone else. Bilam is independent. Later on, when you look at the portion, you'll notice how many times it says the word Am, nation. Am means togetherness. Over here, Bilam is where they go. Now, where did they send to find this Bilam? It says they send him by the river. What river are you talking about? Which river is this? It says the river. Which river? It's not the Mississippi. Which river is this? Euphrates. If it's the Euphrates, which is the river, correct? It's the river that you're talking about. No, it's not the Jordan. It's Petora. It's another. And later on, the Torah tells us where it is. So all the way by the Euphrates, which means, now you'll begin to appreciate the significance, that Bilaam comes all the way from Abraham's hometown. That's where Abraham came from. Lech Lecha Me'aretz, when Abraham begins his travels, that's where he comes from. He also comes from the river, from the Euphrates. Which means they send somebody back to Abraham's hometown to come and take care of the children of Abraham. Who do we have doing this? We have doing this these two nations that are somehow connected to Abraham but not connected to Abraham. Who do they get? They get somebody who is clearly an Abraham wannabe. Why do I say that? Look at what they say to him immediately afterwards. They say that these Jews, these people of Israel, have spread out. They're all over the place. V'atalachana aroli etam. Please curse these people for me. Ki atzum humi meni. For they're so numerous. Ulai uchana kebo. Maybe then we can beat them and chase them out of the land. Ki yodati, for I know, et asher tivrach mevurach, v'asher tuar yuar. For I know that who you bless is blessed, and who is cursed is cursed. Does that sound familiar to you? Do you remember where that came from? It's the very first time we find God speaking to Abraham. What did he say to him? Right from the beginning, when God reaches out to Abraham and says, Lech Lecha, set out from your hometown, from the place that you're born. I'll make you into a great nation. I will bless you, make your name great. And V'avarcha mivarechecha, mekalecha or, who you bless will be blessed, who you curse will be cursed. Which is fascinating, because over here we have Bilaam, at least his PR, his website says, who I curse is cursed, who I bless is blessed. Which means, what is he doing? He's claiming that somehow Abraham's greatness comes from the town that Abraham is born. I guess if somebody wants to start a career in rock and roll, going back to Graceland. It's, you know, Graceland is, right? Well, if you don't know, it's fine. Where Elvis is from? To go back Memphis. To go back and start and to claim a certain thing about your identity, about your powers, about who you are, based upon where you're from. That's what Bilaam is doing.
Well, Abraham didn't claim to have that power. That was Hashem who said, "You're a magnifier. Whatever people do to you, will happen to them."
Correct.
Which is the reverse of what Balak is giving Bilaam.
Well, Balak says about Bilaam, I know about you, and then he gives the same tagline, which means, obviously, Bilaam has advertised using the same tagline, saying, whoever I bless is blessed, whoever is cursed is cursed.
It's a different line there. It's not what Hashem said about
him. The difference is, or the comparison and the contrast is where the whole, you know, in the details is where you'll find what's really interesting over here. But what you do realize now, both in terms of location and in terms of, you know, basic approach. By the way, you can continue. He gets up early in the morning and he mounts his donkey. And all of the terminology over here is very similar to the terminology that we find by Abram. It's not identical. And it's where the similarities are, is where you're able to make the identification. And it's where the differences are that you can then realize really what Bilaam was about. But my point over here, as I said, is simple. It's much simpler than that. We don't have time to get into details. We're not interested in details. We're interested much more in the larger message over here. And the larger message is that I have a confederacy of people who know about Abraham's power. And what do they choose to do? They choose to get either the Abraham wannabe or the anti-Abraham in order to somehow offset that power. The fact that these people, again, according to some rabbinic tradition, may have themselves had this power of cursing themselves, or the power of some kind of demon worship or whatever it was, is fascinating, because it says that then they send a message to Bilaam, and it says they sent him some of their tricks to show what they can do, but they themselves feel they don't have the ability of being victorious. Again, let's be honest right now. If you have people who know the Abraham story, and again, there are different nations that the Jewish people are going to come in contact with. Those who know exactly who they are and what they're about, what is their history and what is their destiny. You'll have those who will just see them as being very strange, have no idea why they do what they do. Bilam knows where they come from. Midian and Moab know where they come from. They could have easily have identified with the Jewish message and said, we know that God promised the land of Israel to the Jewish people. We know this is their destiny to enter into that land. Right? They know this. They know, but they know what God promised to Abraham. They know what the children of Abraham, they know where they've gone, they know where they're going. That part they choose not to do. They know that God has blessed these people, which means that they have a blessing on them. So what do they try to do? Do they try to identify with the blessing? Or do they try to, as any way that they can, to undo the blessing? That's what they try to do, which means that's what's so frightening here. And that's also what's so evil here. They know who the Jews are. They know why they are coming. They know where they are going. They know what they're going to try to accomplish. And they know that this is God's promise. And what do they try to do? They try to find somebody who is this anti-Abraham. But as I said, at the same time, he's an anti-Abraham. Why is he an anti-Abraham? Who's Abraham? Av Hamon Goyim. Who's Abraham? The father of many nations. Who's Bilam? A man without a nation. That's what makes him the anti-Abraham. Abraham is somebody who's fundamentally moral and takes people into his home, right? Abraham opens up his tent, takes people into his tent, and over here you have Bilam looking at the Jews in their tents, and he wants to destroy their tents. He wants to destroy their nation. He wants to curse them and do what he can to destroy them. For one of two reasons, and you can decide which one is worse, either because he's getting paid for it or because he hates them, or both. Does it make that much of a difference? When it comes down to it, is Bilam the kind of person who's using his skills, capabilities, and vision in order to make the world a better place, or using his capabilities in order to make the world a worse place? It comes down to a very simple point. Abraham is somebody who uses the gifts that he has from God in order to reach out to as many people as he can to open up his tent, open up his home, open up his house, open up his heart. Bilam is somebody who is antisocial, and he's a misanthrope. That's what he is. Yeah.
Says that Bilam, Balak said, wait, I'm going to ask God what to do, and God said, go. It's kind of
God doesn't say go the first time.
What?
God says, don't listen to them, and he does, don't do it. And finally, after him, God says, okay, go, but do what I tell you to do. It's like when your kid asks you five times if you can do, they can do something. You say no the first four times. The fifth time when you say yes, you don't say yes because you want them to do it. You say yes because you know that they're going to do it anyway. So at least do it, but do it under the terms that I'm telling you to do it. Which, and read it through. God does not enthusiastically say yes, go for it.
Well, yeah, I understand. I'm not bringing up an argument. I'm just, you know, repeating what it says in the Torah. God, I mean, he's not speaking to an ordinary person. He's speaking to God. And yeah, somewhere along the way, he does get some kind of permission to do it instead of an outright flat no.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a little, like a little contradiction there. I mean, I can't figure it out.
Well, first of all, your contradiction is irrelevant to anything that I've said, right? Yeah. But even if somehow it's related to what I said, which I don't think it is, God tells him no, which really should be it. If somehow you have the ability of speaking to God, which we all do, but you have the ability of hearing what God says, which is more difficult, and you ask God something, God says no, do you really think it's wise to ask a second time or again? Which means when they come a second time with more money, he, instead of saying no, he says, well, let me go to sleep and see what God says to me. I mean, God finally says, okay, you want to go, then go. But God will let come out of his mouth. I mean, God very here, it's fascinating that God very carefully controls what he does and what he doesn't do.
Could it be possible that God said, okay, you're so insistent, I'll let you go, but you're going to bear the consequences of what's going to happen?
It could be. He does bear the consequences at the end. So, right. I mean, he gets executed eventually for this.
I'm going from a point of not knowing.
Yes, I'm just telling you, he does get executed for this eventually, so apparently, and among other things. But again, I specifically didn't want to get into the details, and rather to show you the larger issue about who the people are, and that gives you a much better idea. I mean, eventually what we see, and over here is really where there is this great tension, eventually what we see is that again, standing on the outside, looking in, they see this Jewish nation. They see these beautiful tents. They see the modesty in the tents. And the rabbis tell us how each tent doesn't face the window of the other one, and each one has its own, you know, space. And what Bilam eventually does, again, when you get towards the end of the portion, what Bilam eventually advises them is something which shouldn't surprise us terribly. It tells us that the Jewish men began to sleep with the girls from Moab. Now, first of all, for the girls from Moab to reach out and seduce the Jewish men, should that come as a big surprise to you? Which is, basically, that's something which is within this nation going all the way back to Lot and Lot's daughter. I mean, Lot's daughters went to sleep with her own father. Why should this come as a terrible surprise that that these girls from Moab are now sleeping with the Jewish people? Which, by the way, is fascinating. Bilam fails in his ability to curse the people. But the way that the Jews are eventually brought down is because they end up not having the moral superiority. Which means, the reason that Moab and Midian, as far as I can tell, the reason that they hate the Jews is because the ways that they make them feel. They make them feel inadequate. And if they were to go to the Jews and accept the Jewish law, they can no longer practice life the way they've done till now. So now you have two possibilities. What are the two possibilities? Either reaching up and stretching up your moral system to reach up to the system that you're expected to keep, or, what's the other possibility, is bringing the others down and therefore making yourself feel much better. Because look, they're no better than we are. And to a very large extent, and I'm not going to comment on the essence of the Arab-Israel conflict, but to a very large extent, the reaction in Europe to what goes on in Israel, which is so unfair and so one-sided and so prejudiced, is part of their collective therapy to deal with their own guilt for anti-Semitism which has taken place. Which means if you can show that the Jews act immorally, then you can end up concluding that everybody sometimes acts immorally. It makes you feel much better about your own immorality. Which means, right? You understand what I'm saying?
No, I'm agreeing with you.
That's what's going on in Europe. Because you still have a great deal of guilt regarding the Holocaust and other things. But you can say, oh, look how bad the Israelis are. And again, let's not make any mistake. When they say Israelis, and that's what they say publicly. Privately, they say Jews. It's not Israelis. I think very, very few of them would ever say, no, the Jews are good, it's just the Israelis that are not good. And if they say that, then you know not to believe them. But I think that's part of what's taking place, is that if you're able to show that people are people are people, then you feel better about yourself, even though your historical record has not been all that impressive. I was kidding around with my sons, asking them, okay, who are we supposed to root for in the World Cup now? Do you root for Germany? Okay, that doesn't have to go that far. Do you root for Portugal? You know, they expelled us. Do you root for Italy? They destroyed the Second Temple. Who else do we have left?
France.
So France is the ones that likes us the best. And they knew that was wrong. So it's not a simple thing. I told them Italy. I grew up in an Italian neighborhood in Brooklyn. So I feel closest to Italy. I grew up in Bensonhurst. Everyone was either Jewish or Italian. Let's go back to our point. There's a fascinating statement which is found in one of the great Kabbalistic writers. There's a book which is called the Megale Amukot, which is He Who Reveals the Great Secrets. Over here at the end, when the girls from Moab come down, 24,000 people die. That's what it tells us at the end of the portion. A plague goes through, 24,000 people die. Any of us with a little bit of knowledge of Jewish history knows that there was another time that a plague struck and 24,000 people died, and that was the students of Rabbi Akiva. So in your guts, you know that there's some kind of relationship. I think my eldest son asked me about this when he was 6 years old. And he asked me the question, says, what's with the 24,000 people? I think we just had read the portion, and a couple weeks before then was the time about the Omer, and it's an obvious question. Is there any connection between the 24,000 people? So the Megale Amukot tells us that there was one previous time when 24,000 people died, and this is a very frightening thought. He tells us that when Jacob encamps, when he comes back to Israel, because he sets up a camp, when he sets up a camp, and by the way, a camp is very interesting because it means creating boundaries. It says that Jacob goes and sets a camp. Setting a camp means that you make boundaries around where you're staying. Jacob makes boundaries. His daughter, Dinah, leaves the boundaries, and she ends up meeting this nice boy, or not nice boy, depending on how you remember the story, and they fall in love, or at least he loves her. I don't want to get into all the details of the episode, because I know that the way a lot of people read it is that she was raped, although I will stress it's the one thing that it doesn't say in the text. The other thing that it does say is that he fell in love with her. Now, the way that the Jews normally read the story is that Shechem rapes Dinah, comes and says, I want to marry her. And after he says he wants to marry her, Jacob is outraged, the brothers are even more outraged, and the brothers then surreptitiously say, well, you know what, we can't let our daughter marry somebody who's not Jewish, why don't you circumcise yourself, and then you can convert, and then you can get married to our sister. And according to the way of reading it, is that, you know, the good people are the Jews, and the bad people are the non-Jews, it's the way that we like to read all the stories. And then it says that these two brothers, Shimon and Levi, go and wipe out the entire city. And I hope that at least some of you, I don't expect everyone, but I hope at least some of you recognize that there is a moral problem in this. Right? There is a moral problem. Again, we spoke before about mental health, therapeutically, I'm sure they got their anger out, they got to express themselves, and so on, and this was very good, but as far as a massacre, this is not very good. Wiping out the whole city was not good. The Megale Amukot tells us they killed 24,000 people. And that becomes completely fascinating. Because what he's telling us is that the 24,000 people that die over here, and later on will die by the students of Rabbi Akiva, that there's three different episodes where 24,000 people die, and there is a relationship between the three of them. And that's what we need to understand. Abraham was a man who opened up his tent and doesn't make boundaries. In fact, the rabbis tell us that when God says to Abraham, you should circumcise yourself, Abraham hesitates. His hesitation is, if I circumcise myself, then I will make myself different from all the people around. I'll make myself sufficiently difficult. I may have no impact on them anymore. They'll look at me very differently. And the irony is that God says to him, I will make you into a father of many nations, av hamon goyim, but I want you to do this, which means at the same time you have a dialectic whereby Abraham is going to do something to his person which will make him different from everyone around him, while at the same time he now takes responsibility for everybody around him. That's the tension of what Abraham's life is. To live a life of holiness, following the word of God, and circumcision absolutely symbolizes holiness, and the control over nature, the control over man's natural lustful feelings. But at the same time, he will now be empowered to have an impact over many nations. Abraham is somebody who really spreads his impact upon the people around him. As you've already noticed from the beginning, some of his relatives have a hard time with that because the standards that he sets are so high. His grandson, Jacob, creates boundaries. V'yichan et ha'ir. He creates boundaries. And essentially what he's saying is we need to work on ourselves and not to have interaction with others. And there's a price to be paid for that. Here I'm going to ask you the tantalizing question. Is it possible that Shechem was sincere? And by the way, I do want to stress something. Fundamentally, I don't know what happened between Shechem and Dinah. My guess, by the way, it would be much closer to what you call today a date rape than actually a rape. That things got out of control. Because the strangest part of it is it says that afterwards that he loves her. Doesn't ring true if it was an act of violence that there would be love there. Just doesn't ring true. In fact, we're told another place in the Bible where one of King David's sons rapes his half-sister, Amnon rapes Tamar, and there it says that he had this incredible lust for her, but once he had relations with her, he hated her more than he had ever loved her, and he wanted nothing to do with her, and completely sent her away. That rings much truer. Over here, it sounds like there's the beginning of a relationship. As I said, there's something strange that goes on. But when he goes back to the city and he tells them, I want you all to circumcise yourselves, and all, right away, are we supposed to suspect that all of them are insincere? And as I said, you will find rabbinic opinions that say, yes, they were insincere. In the Megale Amukot, he says, no, it's not that they were insincere. Think about it. If 24,000 people went to circumcise themselves to accept the laws that we have right now, the laws of Abraham, the laws of God, and to join the tribe of Jacob, there's an incredible opportunity which is missed. Now we move fast forward, and we have the Jewish camp. The daughters of Moab come down, and what you have at this point is an opposite reaction. Over here, the Jewish men, instead of being cliquish and being separate and being exclusive, at this point, what do? They open up. And by the way, as they're opening up, they can claim to be the real children of Abraham. Abraham also reaches out to many people. They're also reaching out to many people. Which means there needs to be, and this is difficult to find the exact balance, but there needs to be a balance between opening up, being friendly, having an impact, versus being closed and versus being exclusive. How do you balance these two things which can seem to be very opposite? What actually what's needed is a balance between them. If you appreciate now that the 24,000 here, and by the way, they're mistaken. The 24,000 here are deluding themselves into saying we need to open up a little more. We need to fix the mistake of the previous time of being so exclusive. We can't be so exclusive. What happens by the students of Rabbi Akiva is that they say, look what happens when you're too friendly. Look what happens when you're too nice. Look what happens when you reach out too much. You create catastrophe. What do we need to do? We need to be closed. We need to be much more self-involved. And what happens then? Again, happens tragedy. Which means, ultimately, what we now understand is that there needs to be a balance between opening up and being friendly versus being exclusive. The children of Midian and Moab, they know about the Jewish ideals. They know about opening up the home. They refuse to live by those ideals. They refuse to reach out to the Jews. And what do? They know the power of Abraham. So instead of reaching out towards the power of Abraham and towards the descent of Abraham, what do? They look for the opposite of Abraham and say, well, it must be that you can have this power as well. And they try to use this wizard or whatever he is in order to attack the Jews. When that doesn't work, when you can't attack them in terms of the spiritual side, what do they decide to do instead? Let's attack their other weakness, and their other weakness will be their moral side. What we need as a people is to be strong in terms of the spiritual side and strong in terms of the moral side. To be strong spiritually means to have a connection with God, to have a connection with Torah. And by the way, it's fascinating, but the word Vayechan et ha'ir, Vayechan, they encamped. You know the next time it says that the Jews encamped? By the foot of Mount Sinai. which means there was the encamping of Yaakov, which creates that camp, and you say, okay, there, now it's exclusive. The next time they encamp is by the foot of Mount Sinai. That's how you connect to the spirituality. That's how you're able to bring the Torah down from heaven. But once the Torah is down from heaven, there needs to be a balance between working on oneself, and I say oneself both as an individual and as a nation, versus impacting others and opening up for others around, especially for those who are sincere. I cannot gauge today, listen, let's be honest, I have a hard time gauging the sincerity of people sitting in front of me. I certainly can't gauge the sincerity of people who existed 3,000 years ago, and to know how sincere the people of Shechem were. What's remarkable in the statement of the Magale El Mukod is that he says they were sincere, and those 24,000 people, those 24,000 souls, came back at this point, and that's the souls that take place over here. But over here they do the opposite. Over here they try to be too friendly, and over here they try to reach out in a way which is inappropriate. And then again, he's attacking the students of Rabbi Akiva who become too exclusive. What we need to do in our lives is to be able to create a balance. If we're able to create a balance, then we really become the children of Abraham. Because again, realize what Abraham does. The one time he accepts both mandates from God, to be a father of many nations, which means to have an impact on many nations, which means to be concerned about many nations, to be concerned about starvation, about war, world issues, and not just narrow Jewish issues. But at the same time that Abram takes upon that mandate, he took something else upon him. What was it? He took upon circumcision. He took upon Jewish ritual. He took upon law. He took upon something that will make him different. Which means that it's not a contradiction to be different, but to be very concerned and involved in what goes on outside. That's the balance which needs to exist. That balance, Midian and Moab were not willing to study. They were not willing to reach out to. They're not willing to incorporate in their own lives. Instead, they were frightened and disgusted. They were frightened and disgusted by the fact that the Jews were now coming back. The Jewish camp needs at the one time to be a camp which is holy, a camp which has spirituality, a camp which is able to follow Jewish law, but it also needs to be a camp which is concerned with what goes on outside of the camp. How you do that takes a great deal of sensitivity. It doesn't mean that you then sleep with anybody who's willing to walk into the camp. That's not what it means. Which means concern for outside of the camp is something which takes a great deal of work to do what I said is the most difficult thing, and that is to create the balance. Which means over here, what we see is the failure of those who should have known better, because they were relatives of Abraham, and that's the key to the story. That's the subtext which goes all the way through, versus the challenge that the real descendants of Abraham have. And that's our challenge, to be great in terms of spirituality, but not to be so exclusive that we don't know what's going on outside of our camp. Have a good Shabbos.